Hello and welcome again to another Conservative Historian podcast. This one entitled Form Without Substance, Tojo, Trump, Biden, and the Squire of Gothos. The date is January 2024, and my name is A.D. Tippett. So I wanted to begin by thanking all of you for downloading my podcast. I hope that you have a great 2024, and please check out all of the podcasts that I have produced, as I am now approaching nearly 200 episodes. And on every Monday, I also drop a short form article. These podcasts tend to run, really around 30 minutes. My short form essays that I drop on my Substack site are really meant to be 5, maybe 10 minute reads at tops. And now on with the show. Worthiness is what gives meaning and fulfillment. Success without fulfillment is empty. That's like good looks without goodness. In life, we need substance over form, not form over substance. Shiv Kara. Form and substance are opposite ends of the same coin. Ronald Reagan. In the article Shogun and the Japanese Emperor, written in 2021 by Yami Noguchi, a blogger and freelance writing instructor, the author states of the first official Japanese shogunate. The beginning of the Kamakura shogunate in 1192 marked the waning of the emperor's once real power to a purely symbolic status. In its place, the warrior class, the transition, was the fallout of a years-long war between two clans. Their respective colors, red and white, would take on national significance for centuries to come. Despite the rise of subsequent warlords and several prominent Japanese families vying for power, the form of Japan as an empire, overseen by a divine emperor, continued for nearly 1,000 years up until the end of World War II. Even when the powerful Tokugawa clan took power over the whole of Japan in the early 1600s, they still styled themselves shoguns, but never emperors. The concept of the emperor overseeing Japan was a form, but not the substance of power. Even the Meiji Restoration of 1868 was supposedly about the Tokugawa shogunate losing its power and the emperor being restored to the supreme governing position. In reality, the restoration simply moved political power from the feudal bureaucracy of the Tokugawas to an oligarchy of disaffected samurai who wished to bring modernization to the empire. In the view of the new rulers, the Emperor of Japan continued to serve solely as the spiritual authority of the nation, but his ministers governed the nation in his name. Emperors previous to the Meiji period were housed in Kyoto and were rarely, if ever, seen by the general population. Yet during the 20th century, Emperor Hirohito's portrait was distributed among the people of Japan, and he would even visit troops and be seen in public. These appearances, though, still had two key aspects. He was still considered divine, and he did not make the critical decisions. For example, the Declaration of War of Japan against the United States, delivered immediately after the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, was delivered in Hirohito's name, but the man who actually ordered the declaration was Prime Minister Hideki Tojo. Sometimes the form of power or ideas can be a little bit more subtle. The official name of China today is the People's Republic of China. I always think this name is funny. This brings to mind Voltaire's quip about a 1,000-year-old state located in Central Europe. The Holy Roman Empire was in no way holy, nor Roman, nor an empire. Now, the people, they do not rule in China. It is not a true republic. But at least China is China, so out of the three terms, they got one right. Cuba does not even contain the fiction of the people, as it is known officially as the Republic of Cuba. It may have the form of a republic, but the substance is a dictatorship. So let me take a bit of a right turn here. Why do people like me like Star Trek? There are space battles and cool aliens. But what made the original show so lasting was the personalities and the ideas. For differentiated temperaments, we have the leader, Kirk, part diplomat, part warrior, part lover, and fully the captain. McCoy, the emotional ideologue, and Spock, the logician. The show only lasted for 3 years, but back in the 1960s, a season was, in fact, a season. Sorry, Netflix and all you streamers, but 10 shows, much less 6, is not a season. Star Trek had 29 shows just in its first year, and the 17th among them was called The Squire of Gothos. This particular episode played with the idea of form and substance. In this story, the crew of the Starship Enterprise is taken prisoner by a being so powerful that he makes planets move at his whim and can create matter from energy by simply thinking things into existence. But Trelane, the super alien, is very interested in humanity's violent past. He styles himself a general and loves Napoleon to the point where he creates an 18th century parlor for the crew. But Trelane has a weakness. Now consider this exchange between the captain, McCoy, and Spock. McCoy says, "You should taste his food. Straw would taste better than his meat, and water 100 times better than his brandy. Nothing has any taste at all." At which point Spock says, "It may be unappetizing, Doctor, but it is logical." McCoy sort of snarkily says, "Ah, there's that magic word again. Does your logic find this fascinating, Mr. Spock?" Spock, unperturbed, says, "No. Fascinating is a word I use for the unexpected. In this case, I should think interesting would suffice." Kirk at this point says, "You don't find any of this unexpected, Mr. Spock?" And Spock concludes with, "That his food has no taste? His wine no flavor? No, it simply means that Trelane knows all of the Earth forms, but none of the substance." Sadly, the recent Star Trek movies by J.J. Abrams do not understand the unique nature of the show. His Star Trek is, well, it's basically Star Wars, with the ship-to-ship battles and daring do's of the crew members. Yet, lacking ideas, because his movies were one action set piece to another, he never gave his characters time to breathe. The recent Star Trek movies were the form of Star Trek, but not the substance. And our politics in 2024 are form without substance, in which the dominant factions claim to be one thing, but in substance are actually quite something else. And the most obvious example is Donald Trump. Back in 2015, he used the example of Reagan, who was once a Democrat, to note that though Trump had voted Democrat, he was in reality a conservative. Trump stated, "When you get down to it, I am a conservative person. I am by nature a somewhat conservative person." Again, he would claim it, but was he really it? Now, after getting elected president, many agreed with Trump's assessment. "I think he has conservative instincts, and I think he's starting to govern as a conservative." But up until he started making those decisions as president, it was hard to know, said Matt Schlapp, chairman of the American Conservative Political Action Committee, or better known as CPAC. Trump's record, in many regards, proved that. One example was the effort to curb government regulation. According to Trump's official White House statement, "President Trump's actions to roll back regulations are lifting American families and businesses." Between fiscal year 2017 and 2019, the Trump administration has cut nearly 8 regulations for every new significant regulation, more than fulfilling the promise of Executive Order 13771 to cut 2 regulations for every new regulation imposed. As a conservative, obviously I agree with it. As a conservative, I'm concerned with status power, and obviously, a lot of that status power is exercised not through sweeping laws or legislation, but one regulation at a time. In this regard, Trump was conservative. And there were many other things. The appointment of conservative justices, a tax cut, and progress on Israeli relations with the Arab Gulf states. Yet there were aspects of Trump's presidency that were not conservative. His pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Deal, or TPP to name one. the protectionist Trump nixed a deal whose ultimate goal would have been to marginalize China. Then he ejected NAFTA for the USMCA, a move beloved by, of all people, progressives. In a 2019 Washington Post article, the Democrats crowed about the bill. The revised trade agreement with Canada and Mexico won the enthusiastic support of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka on Tuesday, with the union's backing, signaling to many Republicans that the trade deal was perhaps not in their favor. Pelosi told other House Democrats during a closed-door meeting Tuesday that we ate their lunch, referring to multiple changes White House officials made to the trade deal in recent weeks to win the support from labor groups. And lately, in his 2023 remarks, Trump has moved well away from conservatism. Now I'm defining conservatism here in the Burke, Perk, Soul, and Will vein. One of the tenets of conservatism is a belief in institutions. Even those rife with liberalism, which, let's face it, most of them these days, ranging from the ACLU to the FBI, but they need to be reformed, not gutted, not abolished. One of Trump's proposals is he would fire legions of civil servants to be replaced by, what, Trump loyalists. But let's play some chess here. Another precedent that would enable the next Democrat to do the same. And if you're thinking that these are rife with liberal people already, then again, what you want to do with these institutions is to impose what the Constitution does to our entire government, checks and balances to try to eke and move the ideological nature of a lot of these people out of the work. And of the institutions themselves, writing in the conversation, Karen Amara notes, Trump's rhetoric persistently attacks the free press, the Department of Justice, the FBI, often considered a conservative organization. Trump has attacked military leadership and the integrity of the electoral system. Some of these organizations enforce justice and hold government accountable through free speech, ideals embedded in the conservative principles laid out by no less than Republican Mike Johnson for the Republican Study Committee in 2018. Before you know it, in this regard, we will have the odious spoils system of the mid-19th century, in which every new president would sweep out the old and sweep in the new. Forget even the inexperienced nature of putting civil servants into these roles. But also, think about all the lobbying, all the deals, all of the corruption that was inherent within the spoils system that would be brought back if, in case, this mass firing of the bureaucracy was done. Again, reform the systems, do not gut them. That would be the conservative approach. And I mentioned the tax cut from Trump's term. Trump did very little to cut the government commensurate with that cut, so his deficit ballooned to $8 trillion on his watch. Only a Democrat would be so proud of such an achievement. And as Reagan once said, there's a clear cause and effect here that is as neat and predictable as a law of physics. As government expands, liberty contracts. Adds Amira, using the bully pulpit in his presidential powers, Trump has threatened retaliation against companies that move jobs overseas, increased the national debt, instigated trade wars by raising tariffs, and gave subsidies to farmers who were harmed in the trade war process. These behaviors and policies also fly in the face of conservative principles. And finally, Trump carries the form of a tough guy, a fighter. Yet under his watch, our adversaries were either unaffected by his actions or experienced prosperity. Ranging from China, Iran, Russia, and North Korea, none were inhibited nor intimidated by the Trump presidency. And in all of these cases, he would double down on his first term. And remember those conservative victories, particularly the tax cut and SCOTUS justices? They were enabled, with the help, by the likes of Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, who have been subject now to the most withering of commentary from Trump and his supporters. up until including making fun of McConnell's wife's Chinese ethnicity, and it should be noted that Elaine Chao served as transportation secretary during the Trump administration. As recently as November 29, 2023, Trump stated that he would use the government to come down hard on media outlets such as NBC and make them pay for its critical coverage of Republicans after previously vowing to investigate parent company Comcast if elected. This media intervention, seemingly a positive given the nature of left-wing media, creates an alarming precedent, as any future Democratic president would feel entitled to such interventions, not just on Fox or National Review, but on True Social and perhaps X as well. Now, I get it. In the Obama administration, I understand that using officials who conducted electronic surveillance of both the New York Times reporter James Risen and Fox News correspondent James Rosen in an effort to identify their sources was just such an act, a completely odious and wrong act. It is wrong in any circumstances for these governments to impose themselves because they don't like the opinions of media outlets. But the right, becoming the left, mimicking the Obama administration, is not the answer. And increasingly, right-wing media has only the form of conservatism. Here is a quote from Elizabeth Warren. "Libertarian economics is a scam perpetrated by the beneficiaries of the economic system, and also that William F. Buckley was a villain." Okay. I am indulging a ruse, valued listener, so let me apologize in advance. Warren did not say these things. Bernie Sanders did not say these things. AOC did not say these things. No, it was Tucker Carlson. But can you tell the difference? In fact, Carlson has supported many of Warren's economic positions in the past. And earlier I quoted Matt Schlapp of CPAC. I am old enough to remember, which was basically 12 years ago, remember when George Will and Jonah Goldberg were CPAC speakers. In today's CPAC, they would not make it to the stage because of the sea of spit that would descend upon them. Putting Schlapp's personal conduct aside, which admittedly is difficult, there's lots of allegations against him, but Ron DeSantis chose not to attend this year's event, and little doubt that if there was a fall version, Nikki Haley would no longer be welcome, though she attended the February soiree. This shows the state of the Conservative Political Action Committee. Given the new populist nature, perhaps the right substance to form might be renaming it the Populist Political Action Committee, or more precisely, PPAC. In an article entitled "Trump and the Conservative Movement," author Andres Burke is correct about one thing. United under Reagan by anti-communism, the U.S. conservative movement is now deeply divided. This division was already visible in the so-called Sarah Palin's conservative populism in the Tea Party movement. I would argue, well, he said he was right about that. He was right about the deep divisions. I would argue that this happened with Tea Party. The fundamental premise of the Tea Party was small government. The fundamental premise of a lot of what Trump is proposing is not. But then Burke gets something very wrong. Trump's candidacy referred to the tradition of American conservatism, appealing to the founding fathers, the Constitution, and national pride in supporting the idea of metaphysical freedom, ontologically rooted in being greater than the autonomous will of the individual. One of the core tenets of the Founding Fathers in conservatism in itself is the reduction of the state's power, hence separation of power and checks and balances, and also leaving to the state those powers not enumerated in the Constitution. In other words, one of the things the founders wanted to do was push power as close to the people as possible. Trump has repeatedly said this year that he would use the state's power to exact, in his own words, retribution. Of course, the Democrats also favor a specific form, of which there is little substance. They are the party of the downtrodden, the forgotten man, as their patron saint of progressivism, Franklin D. Roosevelt, noted in the 1930s. The substance is something else. During COVID, we saw those who could work from home in other words, the professional class, continue with their work, while those who had to travel were penalized. The Democrats are big supporters of the teachers' unions, and again, during COVID, this support was at the expense of student education. The Democrats would reorder parts of society for the 0.01% of the population who are trans. I can argue all of the trans issues in another podcast, but allowing males to compete in female sports is not for the betterment of the girls. The left claims the mantle of professing advancement for African Americans, yet in two key areas, defunding the police and support for the public teachers' unions are detrimental to the very groups they purportedly are trying to help. In one case, it exposes African American communities to greater crime, and in the second, it keeps African Americans in poorly performing schools. And in their current leader, there is the form, but not the substance. And what is the form? Why is a kindly, grandfatherly figure who gets the working man and is moderate in his politics? No. So let's just start with the image of Grandpa Joe. In a piece entitled, "Joe Biden's Brand is Being Tested Like Never Before" by NBC News, a non-conservative outlet, Jonathan Allen and Natasha Korecki state, "Some of the president's Democratic allies are worried about a potential fallout from a confluence of family drama spilled into the public review and, of course, Republican attacks that cut at the bedrock of Biden's longtime political appeal." Republicans also say Biden's Justice Department tried to give Hunter Biden a sweetheart plea deal on federal tax and firearm possession charges, a deal that fell apart last month after a judge questioned its terms. At the same time, a federal special counsel is investigating Biden's handling of classified documents following his two terms as vice president. In a matter of a much more personal nature, Biden recently acknowledged, for the first time, that he has a seventh grandchild. Who knew? Navy Joan Roberts, the four-year-old daughter of Hunter Biden, who wrote in a memoir that he doesn't remember his encounter with his mother. The recent revelations with Hunter Biden really are in conflict with the current perception of his image of being squeaky clean. Mike Noble, the CEO of the nonpartisan Noble Predictive Insights and a preeminent pollster in the Southwest, said of the president. And regarding the form of moderate Joe, his support for the $6 trillion infrastructure bill and all of his Green New Deal rhetoric, his hiring of Lina Khan at the FTC, or the continued presence of Julie Sue at Labor and a host of other policies, shows that Joe is in lockstep with the progressives on pretty much every issue save support for Israel. And even in that essential conflict, his support seems to be wavering at the time of this recording. Yet, I have been opposing progressivism for years, since my first presidential vote, which was cast decades ago. I marched in solidarity with those supporting Scott Walker against the Wisconsin teachers' unions in 2010, and have been obviously in opposition to progressive values until this very day. Yet, after 2020, I find myself in this cleft stick between progressivism, no choice for me, and the populace now running the GOP. Many Trump supporters feel I will fall in line in November this year, and I recognize that of the roughly 30 elections in which I have cast a vote, I am still waiting to see the ideal candidate, nor will I ever. But when the form of something is so different from the substance of which I hold dear, I have little choice but not to support that form, to not support a false form, to not support something of which lacks the substance. Another quote from the Squire of Gothos encapsulates my feeling about Trump and why, after voting for him in 2016 and 2020, I will not in 2024. When the character of Trelane senses disapproval from Spock, the latter explains to him, "I object to you. I object to intellect without discipline and power without constructive purpose." The Squire of Gothos ends in a reveal that Trelane was both a super being and a child of super beings. His behaviors were not born out of great power, but childishness, pique, and even brattiness. As his super parents explained to Kirk in this exchange, Trelane says, because remember, Trelane might have superpowers, but he is still a little boy. He says to his parents, "You always stop me when I'm having fun." And the father says to him, "You're disobedient and cruel. We've told you before." And his mother says, "Time to come in now, Trelane." Trelane, in his pique, says, "But I don't want to come in. I won't. I'm a general and I won't listen to you." And the father says, "Enough, Trelane. Come along." The father being explains to Kirk, "We regret that the life paths of yourself and your companions have been disturbed." Kirk asks, "Who are you? Who is Trelane?" In which the mother simply says, "You must forgive our child. The fault is ours for indulging him too much, and he will be punished." This 1967 production sometimes feels just a bit too prophetic for my well-being. Unfortunately, though they have been indulged to the extreme, no one has given much discipline to the likes of Crump or Carlson. Trelane was a bratty child. The form of Crump as an effective, manly, competent, or conservative figure is as much a fiction as Trelane himself. As always, thank you very much for listening to this latest production of the Conservative Historian Podcast.